Thank you, Jeff. Now we'll start off the Q&A session with the questions that were posted online. Most of the speakers are able to stay beyond 2:30. If attendees have to log off at 2:30, the answers to the questions will be part of the transcript that will be posted in a couple weeks. So the first question came from Chuck Beck, and it was directed at Roger. Did you ever serve as CO, CEU, Prov?
Hi, this is Roger, Chuck, Semper Paratus. Chuck and I are both former Coast Guard officers, and Chuck is trying to figure out exactly where we crossed paths. I think it was in Miami, Chuck.
Okay, the next question. Have you considered making your port training available online?
Oh, okay. We're trying to understand exactly. I think that's the port planning and investment toolkit. Actually, the toolkit itself is on our website, and I think it's on AAPA's website as well. So if you look at strongports.gov, you'll see it there. But it's an interesting question about actually turning it into training modules, which we're going to go take back and think about it because there might be some opportunity there we hadn't thought of. So thank you for the question.
Roger, can you provide more information on the Port Talk series you mentioned that Barb Nelson is heading up?
Yes, certainly. And I have Barb Nelson sitting here to make sure I get this right. But, you know, a lot of the discussion today, and it was really well put together because it was at virtually every level of government, talked about how the ports need to be part of, as a matter of fact, in Virginia's case, they have a seat on the MPO. Other ports, we've found, don't know what MPO stands for. So those are the two goalposts, and of course, all ports fall somewhere in between. And you've seen the importance of those relationships. So what we've done is put together this Port Talk program so that whatever level of current sophistication, the relationship between the port, the MPO, the state DOT, the municipality, even the congressional representation is, our program is aimed at it increasing that to a higher level. So you get from knowing what an MPO stands for to being on the MPO and actually having them, having the port integrated into the planning. Basically, we have three levels of doing that. The first is a fairly brief consult where we will either do it by phone or meet at the port and try and understand what the current state is. The second is sort of a port talk light, which is about a half a day that we do sort of at the ports or MPO or whatever the case may be. And that's to take the relationships to the next level. And then once we're at the highest level, we can actually bring the ports, the MPO, the DOT, you know, hopefully a fairly decent contingent into Washington, D.C. And we spend an entire day with that group here hosting them, working on the issues that the ports and the planners have. If they have dredging issues, we'll invite the Corps of Engineers, our partners from AAPA, perhaps some of the other federal funding mechanisms that you've heard discussed, so it would be custom tailored to them. And that's sort of like the graduate program for Port Talk.
Okay, next question. How is the Grow America going to change what we do with Map 21 and the ports?
Yeah, Grow America has actually a pretty robust freight element to it. It does not carve out specific port or maritime funding programs or rules, but within the larger umbrella of freight, it calls for additional planning mechanisms and all of that. Probably the most important of which, though, is it has provisions for a $10 billion grant program that's sort of like Tiger Grants, but over the, I think it's a four-year period of the proposed legislation, it's a lot more dollars per year, and it does include port and maritime projects.
So this is John with AAPA. I mean, just to add on to what Roger's saying, I mean, I think that Grow America really takes a strong step in the right direction in the sense that, yes, it's a $10 billion freight program, but it really drives on what's already been accomplished. And I say that by, for example, there is that half of the $10 billion is for a discretionary program, which is like Tiger, but then the other half is a formula program that goes out to every state, which I think is going to be, you know, very useful to not just ports, but the freight network in general. And the other thing is it's really driven a lot by the state freight plans that were laid out in MAP 21. So the work that states have been doing, the work that the state advisory freight committees have been doing with their MPOs and with the USDOT would really come to fruition if, you know, something like Grow America were passed into law.
Okay, next question. This one is also for you, John. Would the association consider allowing a small set-aside from the Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund and or the Inland Waterway Trust Fund or port planning initiatives that could bring states, DOTs, MPOs, and private enterprises together for P3s and other local and regional development?
Well, first of all, it's not our decision, unfortunately. What our policy on the HMT has been, spend it for what it's, you know, was what it was intended for, and that's for maintenance and dredging, and you know, keeping the federal navigation channels clear. You know, WERDA did move forward with HMT, and you know, provided you know some donor equity pots, and you know, what I mentioned at the beginning of my presentation is one of our coalitions that we lead is really kind of hitting appropriation marks, so HMT funding that typically should, that is collected and should be going to, you know, maintaining our channels and really go and, you know, enhancing or maintaining our infrastructure, making sure it's used for that, that's been our priority and our focus.
Okay, another question. How do we make the case for maritime freight? How do we shift more long-haul goods movement from trucking to the waterways and rail? In New York City, many electeds believe that the highest and best use for our land is housing development. This threatens existing port facilities, let alone any hopes for expansion. And coming on to that question as well, out of Seattle, is certainly a port's ability to oversee and influence local land use decisions undoubtedly varies, depending upon the port's legally defined role within state or region. This is an interesting question for the presenters to comment on. Anybody have any thoughts?
This is Roger. I'll take a first shot at it, and then everybody else can chime in. We're starting to use the phrase silent engine for ports because until they really hit the headlines, and it's not usually a good news story, it's really hard for them to sort of get their visibility. The land use issue, we're seeing more and more of. You know, a few years back it was San Diego, it's in the Pacific Northwest, certainly any place, as we push for the gentrification of the nation. And I think, you know, some of the things Ben's doing with elevating freight within the state are also things we need to do at the city, at the municipality level.
We can skip the three tiers question, right? Someone answered that online.
The municipal planners and the ports, yes. And then getting the story into the headlines on their value is really important. Ultimately, in San Diego, that was what kind of held off the sports arena, and it's at least now still a container term.
Yeah, that's right. This is Ben here from the California Transportation Agency. Yeah, San Diego is a prime example of how the port has become sort of surrounded with inland development. But it is important to elevate the issue of freight within your state, as we're trying to do here in California, and sort of integrate freight planning into all aspects of planning, whether it's land use, air quality, energy, even in highways. So our freight mobility plan informs a number of other efforts here in California on the state level. I mean, it's really raising the issue and making it aware, and having the champions in the state is important. We have one important person here was mentioned earlier, is Kristen Dikas, who is the port director of Port of Hueneme here in California, and she is a prominent advocate for ports and is a member of the National Freight Advisory Committee. She works with our California Freight Advisory Committee, and I believe she's now the president of the American Association of Port Authorities. But I mean, those are people who aren't necessarily created there. We're sort of lucky to have such people like Kristen to make these issues aware and to put pressure on local municipalities and local entities to incorporate planning, freight planning, into their future forecasts.
This is, I was just going to add, this is Florin from Port of Virginia. It's not always easy to shift freight from, you know, mode to mode. The sweet spot, if you will, for truck to rail, it's based on economics. It's generally 500 miles. So to go less than 500 miles, and there have been cases where it does work, oftentimes there's an incentive involved to, you know, cause it to shift from one mode to the other. And then likewise, when you're looking on the water side with marine highway barging, there really needs to be kind of a an amount of freight that wants to move between those two points. So there's quite a bit, in our case, there's quite a bit of freight that moves between Richmond and Hampton Roads. I-64 is somewhat of a congested route, so in some cases, the shippers prefer to put it on the water because it's a much less congested route, but it's also a route that's a bit more expensive, so there are incentives that are involved to cause that mode shift to occur.
And this is Rob Case, and I would just add that as far as the lady mentioned, the elected officials in New York, you might look at the video that Jeff produced, which is, I put the URL in the chat box there, and that sort of thing, I think, is maybe effective in reaching elected officials.
And this is Roger. If I could mention a couple of things, we obviously have been working with Jeff and his team for some time on the 64 Express. That's the service between Richmond and Virginia ports. And the 580, the one between Stockton and Oakland, was also mentioned a couple times. And we've got on our website a product that's titled Factors for Success. While the 580 service has been suspended, at least at the moment, we learned a lot of things about what the elements are that are sort of necessary to be present, and Jeff kind of touched on them. So you might find that helpful. The other is that one of the challenges we see is that the benefits that are derived from shifting freight to the water are often not benefits to the operator of the vessel or the cargo owner, but rather benefits to the public. Like Jeff mentioned, you know, the added benefit of reduced emissions, especially if you're in a non-attainment area. Or, as a matter of fact, the 64 Express, they put off a widening of that interstate that was, I don't know, on the order of, you know, $500 million or something. And there was a public decision that said, you know, kicking in literally, you know, decimal dust worth of money to move some of the freight to the water was cheaper than the widening. The trick is, how do you monetize the public benefit so that the service is a going concern? And they've been more successful in Virginia than many other places. And it's interesting, if you would use the analogy of a metro system, almost every subway and bus system is subsidized because that's just cheaper than widening the roads to bring them in by car. If you would picture some of these marine highways as sort of a freight metro, then all of a sudden, we've already got the model in place. We just need to move it to freight. So those are a couple of the challenges, but also opportunities to address getting some more of the freight on the water and you know, helping mitigate some of the congestion.
Okay, next question. Apparently there was a short sea shipping operation, barges, that were transferring containers to from the Port of Oakland to the Port of Stockton. Since this wasn't a visible short-haul rail intermodal operation, not profitable for Class 1 carriers, most of the outbound containers hauls out of Stockton were supposedly hay and other agricultural products for export. Is this short-haul marine movement still going on in the Bay Area?
Yeah, this has been here. I think it was just mentioned that it was the barge service was suspended, but I believe I know it's still working on a demand-based sort of operation. So if there's the demand, they'll send a barge down the river or vice versa back up to Stockton. But again, I mean, using those routes, it's important to make the case why they're so important, and I think we try to work on that, and we included some good key points in our freight mobility plan. Is, you know, if you're taking X amount of trucks off the parallel highway, that reduces congestion, which leads to reduction in GHG emissions, as well as a reduction in maintenance costs, as you don't have the heavy trucks, as many heavy trucks going up and down the city highway corridor as the containers on the barge. So that's an important marine route into our overall network system, our freight network, and it's there, and we're doing everything we can here to bring the attention it needs to a higher level.
Okay,
Roger, you know, some of these that have either been tried and weren't.
Those last two questions still.
Striking the economic
balance. Two more questions. The last one looks like it was answered, but
in several cases,
before,
we think maybe
the speaker's report increased attention to stronger last mile connector.
The one that Ben was just talking about, you know, they're struggling to manage emissions issues, which the marine highway can help. One of the ports there has increasing delays at the gate with trucks going through the front gate, so moving some of them sort of out the back gate, if you would, can be helpful there. And some of the ports, including
Lowe's,
are also running into challenges
because
a lot of those trucks go right through residential communities as soon as they get through the gate. So some of those frictions, as they increase, and if we get higher costs for fuel, things like that can bring these services closer to the tipping point where they do make sense, or they need a little less public investment to get to yes. So over time, you know, there may be more of them that become feasible.
Okay. Do the speakers support increased attention to stronger last-mile connector definitions, prioritization, and preservation by federal highway states, MPOs, and in particular the local governments that host and operate the last-mile segments?
Well, this is John with AAPA, and I mean, I guess I'd have to know kind of what the language is, but I mean, I think overall, you know, what we hear from our members is, you know, increasingly first and last mile projects are important, not only to kind of catch up to, you know, where we should be, but also to kind of, you know, handle the projected growth and increase in metropolitan populations.
Do you want me to open up to
questions? So, I mean, yeah, we think it should be, you know, a priority.
No.
And this is Roger. The National Freight Advisory Committee, link with Kristen Dekus was mentioned a little earlier. I was actually the DOT head for a subcommittee on that, aptly titled First and Last Mile. And they made a significant number of recommendations that were ultimately adopted by the full committee. The first and last mile connectors, especially as they relate to ports, are certainly among the top opportunities and challenges in just about any freight expert discussions.
Do you want me to ask that last one? Okay. Okay. The Northeast Diesel Collaborative is speaking with stakeholders on the development of clean corridors along the East Coast main transportation corridors that would help promote the adoption of alternative fuel technologies with infrastructure located at strategic locations. We are looking at how we can better coordinate with MPOs and key freight partners on development. Interested to hear from speakers on thoughts on the important partners that need to be around the table to help promote clean transportation corridors, not only in the Northeast, but around the country.
This is Roger. Certainly at the federal level, we work with the Clean Diesel Collaborative, have participated in some of their webinars. I think we have more opportunity to further integrate that, as well as some of the other, things like diesel engine replacement and all of that.
I sent you the evaluations.
That's one of the things that the Strong Ports is endeavoring to do. Try and be a little bit more of a one-stop shop, because it must be pretty baffling to ports, MPOs, DOTs to figure out, which of the federal programs applies to their scenario. So going back to the port talk mention, if some of those programs present opportunities to a port or a region, we would reach out to them, and I think we have something like 20 federal agencies that have agreed to participate in upcoming port talks, in cases where their programs, would come to bear.
Yeah, this is Jeff Thorne with the Port Authority. I think there's an organization called the Coalition for Responsible Trucking, CRT. I may have that acronym wrong, but I think they're all about that, with clean corridors, clean fuels. If you contacted me, I could get you some more information on that. I'd say they'd be a key partner.
This is John with AAA. I think there's also the DERA Coalition, the Diesel Emissions Reduction Act. It's a program that's run out of EPA, but it's been very port friendly. And I think that's certainly a place to start. And I believe the person who asked the question probably is very familiar with DERA. And then also, of course, there's CMAQ. Funding from the transportation bill that has been used to help kind of in clean corridor port type projects, but I think again this is where Strong Ports could really be helpful in one, help identify some of these corridors and integrating the various tools that could be used to really kind of push a clean corridor concept forward.
Hey, John, this is Roger. Just to add to that, for the internal DOT funding mechanisms, and I'll throw out the acronyms because most folks are familiar with TIFIA, RRIF, CMAQ, private activity bonds, that the Build America Transportation Investment Center that I mentioned is striving to be the one-stop shop for those programs. And for us, I mentioned a couple of the pilot projects, the seven ports that we're working with, we're sort of bringing them to that group so that we can sort of, decode the federal funding mechanisms and help them navigate that. Sort of our next step beyond that is the federal mechanisms that are not necessarily within the Department of Transportation. So that'll be one of the future things we do, hopefully in the near future, under the Strong Ports umbrella.
Okay, that concludes our question and answer session. Thank you all for attending today's seminar. The recorded version of this event will be available within the next few weeks on the Talking Freight website. The next seminar will be held on April 15th, and the topic is still to be determined. Registration is not yet available, but I will send a notice out through the Freight Planning Listserv announcing the topic and the availability of registration. I encourage you to join the Freight Planning Listserv if you have not already done so. So thank you, speakers, and have a good day, everyone.